Welcome to Fried, the Burnout Podcast. I'm your host, Kate Donovan, burnout expert, keynote speaker, and author focused on burnout as a match issue at work. Fried looks at burnout as information, not failure. When people, roles, expectations, leadership behaviors, and systems fall out of alignment, burnout is often the signal. Seasons 1 through 10 of Fried focus primarily on individual burnout and recovery, and those episodes are still available. You can use the Fried episode finder to find the conversations that best match what you're dealing with right now. Starting in season 11, the focus shifts to the workplace. The conversations center on how leaders and organizations can improve match and get rid of burnout in realistic, sustainable ways. I also work directly with companies and events through burnout and emotional intelligence keynotes, workshops, and longer-term advisory work. If burnout has been getting your attention, this podcast will help you understand what it's pointing to and how to find a better match.
Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Got each other on our side, plus all the folks at Fried, the Burnout Podcast.
Fried fam. You know that I'm lucky enough now to have had this podcast long enough that I get to talk to the people I want to talk to instead of only the people who will volunteer because you're new, you have a podcast that nobody's heard of, and they're like, I'll do it. And it's some weirdo from around the corner that you have no idea what's going on. But now I get to be a little more picky, which is lucky me. And I met someone in 2025. It was April or March at the... I always call it the Institute. It's not the Institute. The Initiative for Purpose and Flourishing at NYU Stern. And he spoke there. And a lot of people spoke during that time. And he really stood out to me. So today you get the pleasure of meeting Zach Mercurio, who is an author, researcher, and leadership development facilitator specializing in purposeful leadership, mattering, and meaningful work. He advises leaders in organizations worldwide on practices for building cultures that promote well-being, motivation, and performance. He also holds a PhD in organizational learning, performance, and change, and serves as one of Simon Sinek's Optimist instructors, teaching a top-rated course on creating mattering at work. His new book, which we'll talk about today, is The Power of Mattering, How Leaders Can Create a Culture of Significance. He's been featured on Harvard Business Review, Forbes, Psychology Today, ABC News, just a couple of places that maybe you've heard of. Zach, welcome to Fred.
Thanks, Kate. I'm glad to be here. I'm glad that it all came full circle from March.
It was March. Okay. I couldn't remember whether it was March or April.
Yeah.
Last year. And since then, Susie will be on the podcast shortly. And I had Jerry Colonna last week, so I was happy to see his name pop up in your book. Last season, I mean, so I was happy to have his name pop up in your book too. And I thought, like, the communities are just melding. So Zach, here's where we're going to start. I read your book and I have it open in my Kindle notes with all my notes, but my notes are longer than your book. So we're not going to get through all of that because that's not going to be possible. When I heard you speak the first time, I was transfixed by the idea of mattering over belonging. So that's where I would like to start. Can you pull those two apart for people?
Sure. And I'll pull a third one apart too, which is inclusion.
Yeah, let's do that.
Well, belonging is being picked for the team. So belonging is feeling welcomed, accepted, part of something. So belonging is part of. Inclusion is being asked to play in the game. Inclusion is being invited to take an equal active role in a group. But mattering is feeling that the team wouldn't be complete without you. Mattering is feeling significant to and important to the people around you. I can feel like I belong, that I'm part of something, I'm welcomed, I'm accepted. I can feel that I'm included, I'm represented in a space. But I could have no one notice that I'm a caretaker for a parent. I could have no one be able to name my unique gifts relative to anybody else in the room. I might have nobody ever show me how I'm uniquely needed. So belonging and inclusion are important, but there's a third leg of that stool that's been missing, which is the interpersonal experience of mattering, of feeling significant to and important to other people, that comes from feeling valued and knowing how we add value to their lives.
So one of the reasons that this hit me was because the concept of belonging, I've always found a tiny bit problematic. Not because I don't believe in belonging. I mean, I know, I understand it's important. I've read all the research. I get it. But because it's not always natural and people want it to be. Like by nature, right? We have oxytocin as one of our hormones. It's called the love hormone. However, when oxytocin is high in a group, so there's a lot of bonding and someone new comes in from the outside, it's natural for that group to outwardly attack, even violently, that newcomer to the group in order to protect the group. So oxytocin is the love hormone, but it's also the protect the group hormone. And so the idea of belonging and it being thrown around as something that we should just automatically all be doing is hard for me to accept because it's not actually our nature.
Mm.
And the difference when you were talking about mattering for me was like, this is an intentional act for everyone all the time. Almost no one does this like super by accident.
Right. Mattering is interactional.
Yes.
As well. So when we study mattering, mattering happens in moments.
Right.
It doesn't happen through programs or initiatives. Like you can cultivate belonging through a program or an initiative. You cultivate mattering through an interaction.
With one person at one
With
time.
With one person at one time.
Yeah.
So it's I help you feel seen, help you feel heard. Make sure that I am naming the unique gifts that you bring me. I am naming how you're uniquely needed. I'm feeding that back to you. And the mechanism is called reflected appraisals in psychology. Mm-hmm. So we build our sense of self through interactions with others. When we get these signals, it adds to our belief system. That's why that notion of you are enough is actually biologically, psychologically, and sociologically
Incorrect. Untrue. Yes.
You are not enough on your own.
Right.
And that's good because what it means is that you have this responsibility to create these interactions and relationships with others, but also that knowing that you're reliant on others can help you truly invest in building communities and building relationships around you in which you feel that you matter and you're helping other people feel that you matter. But we build our sense of self together. And so those signals we get from others help to build our belief that we're significant. And those signals happen in moments, very small moments that are accumulated over time.
When did this become apparent to you that you were like, oh shit, this mattering matters?
There was a few oh shit moments. I mean,
yeah.
I think one of them was in my dissertation. So we embedded ourselves with a group of custodians, janitors. I mean, these people are in jobs where they are systematically overlooked. Mm-hmm. They work late night shifts literally to be invisible when nobody's there. And so we wanted to know how what makes work meaningful. We actually didn't even use the word mattering then, but what made work meaningful in this difficult occupation in which people are walking by, throwing a piece of trash, looking at a custodian and walking right by. And one of the things that we found was that those who experienced high levels of meaningfulness in their work, nothing changed with regard to the pleasantness or unpleasantness of the task. What changed is that they were tended to be recipients of more moments in which somebody looked them in the eye, remembered their name.
Yeah.
Knew something about their personal life and checked in on them, reminded them of what the place would look like if they weren't there. Mm-hmm. There was one supervisor of a custodian who would start every day by having them sit and visualize what the place would look like if they went on strike. That was his motivational tactic. He would say things like, if it wasn't for you, you know, this wouldn't be possible. He would go show them the before and after of a room. He would show them the difference that they made. And so people who were recipients of these moments tended to thrive objectively versus others who didn't have as many of these moments, didn't have as many of these people in their lives. And we've gone on to then survey thousands of people, and mattering happens in these moments. That experience of mattering, motivation is a result of mattering. Meaningfulness is a result of mattering. Everything starts when we believe that we're significant. And on the flip side, it's hard for anything to matter to someone who doesn't first believe that they matter. And so you fast forward to the pandemic and then, you know, 5 years after, and you start seeing things like WorkHuman finding that 30% of people, quote unquote, self-report that they feel invisible in work. You start seeing things like 65% of people feel perpetually underappreciated. You start seeing Gallup in 2025, last year, finding that we're more disengaged than ever. Yeah. This is despite billions of dollars spent on programs, perks, pay increases, DEI programs, well-being programs. Yet people are more disengaged than ever. And you look at a data point there that says that just 39% of people feel that somebody cares for them as a person at work. And then you look at another hidden data point that just 30% say that someone invests in and sees their unique gifts. And you pull it all together and you realize this is a mattering deficit. This is, people are having lower quality interactions. They're not the recipients of bad recognition programs, or they're not getting perks, or pay is pretty stable. In fact, it's gone up about 42% on average over the past 8 years. It's really not that. It's that people don't feel seen. They don't feel heard. They don't feel noticed. They feel like they're in a room potentially with friends and nobody knows anything about them. So that's what led us to this work.
Let me see if I can find this section that I was thinking about. Because at one point you started talking about where mattering and burnout overlap. And I was like, okay, here we go. And I've been thinking about that a lot. Because most of the time, burnout work on an organizational level is spoken about from a mindset standpoint or a resilience standpoint, not a biological standpoint, which I think is a massive mistake. My background, I'm an acupuncturist. My master's degree is in Chinese medicine. So my first degree is Chinese medicine. So my view of most things is through health first, and then mindset and organizational patterns and everything else. And when I started to read the section, I'm not going to find it now, but when I started to read the section about burnout, I was like, oh, I'm wondering now how much mattering influences things like inflammation. You know, like I started to think about like what is the biological underpinning of why something like this makes such a significant difference. Like one of the studies that you wrote about was there was the urgent care centers, and one of them out of 10 did a quarterly 30-minute meeting with each person in the staff, and then that person had lower levels of exhaustion for 2 years following the interactions. 2 years. That's biology. You can't just think your way to that. Like there's something going on there on a biological level that makes that change. So can we talk about that some more? I just, whatever thoughts popped up when I said that, can you mention them? Because I'm curious.
Cortisol exists to keep us alive.
Of course.
So when a survival instinct is threatened, we get flooded with cortisol. That's really all it is.
That's it.
And when perpetual survival instincts are threatened, when we can't sleep, when we don't have time to eat, when we don't have time to take care of our bodies, when we don't feel that we matter, which is a survival instinct, we are flooded with cortisol because your body really desperately wants you to react to this, do something. Mattering, to matter is a survival instinct. The first thing we do as human beings is search to be important to somebody. In fact, if we did not matter to another person, if somebody listening did not matter to another person enough to keep them alive, they wouldn't be here listening right now.
Right.
So we have to be important to one another. It's a survival instinct. It's like sleeping and eating. And when it's absent, we get flooded with cortisol. When it's present, our body goes out of fight or flight, and we're able to expand, build relationships, and build the support system, the ecology that helps us to persist.
Yeah.
One of my favorite studies is a study in Tennessee where researchers followed 1,000 people for over 6 months. They took blood and urine samples. They were measuring for objective levels of cortisol or fight or flight hormones. And then they measured them on how many relationships they had in their life in which they felt seen, heard, valued, and needed by using a general mattering scale. And over 6 months, objectively, those who had more relationships in their life in which they felt that they mattered to people had lower cortisol levels in their blood and urine samples than people who did not. I'm reminded of a book, great book. It's called Compassionomics, where researchers had an anesthesiologist come in before a procedure and put his hand on a person's shoulder and ask them if they had any concerns and anything that he could help alleviate. And then they had another group where they did the same procedure. They didn't bring anybody in. They just gave him an opioid to reduce pain afterwards. They measured both of them on pain levels. Having the anesthesiologist demonstrate that you mattered to them actually had a higher effect on pain tolerance than an opioid.
Yeah, this is like super unsurprising to me. There's in the world of Chinese medicine, we talk about setting a lot. What kind of setting is your patient in when they're being healed? What kind of setting are you creating with your words and with your actions? And what kind of like, and there was a co-study done by Beth Israel and Harvard. It was called the Center of Placebo Studies. And they were looking
fascinating.
And they were looking at all stuff like that. Like if you change the color of the walls in the waiting room, if you shift the music in the waiting room, and all of those things, if I think about it now that I'm talking to you out loud about it, all of those things say, hey, we know that you're coming in here and you're stressed out, but you matter. And we're trying to do everything that we can to make this as comfortable as possible.
It's a powerful thing to be seen. Even in your environment, there's no powerful experience of being seen than to know that your presence has been thought about. And I think when we think about leaders, leaders are architects of environments that create these moments where people get those signals that we're seen, heard, valued, or not.
Yeah.
And the danger is leaving it up to chance. I mean, there's a lot of people that talk to me like, Zach, well, of course, you know, of course, like, this is great. Like, why do you have a job? Why do you research this? Why do you write about it? I mean, seriously.
Like, we know this is true.
I had somebody yesterday, a CEO, say, well, I'm not going to tell my leaders how to tie their shoes. She was joking because this is so obvious that if you're a leader, you should be doing this. And this is the problem, right? That this common sense idea that we should be showing people how they're needed, that they're seen, that they're heard, is common sense. It's so embedded in who we are, but it's not common practice.
Yeah.
We tend to underdevelop and underappreciate and pay less attention to the skills that are required to do this every day. And, you know, over the past 25 years of using digital communications to get out of social situations in which we develop these skills, we've become worse at it.
Yeah.
At a time where we need it most to address this mattering deficit.
All right. So I have two things. First, I want to go over the noticing, affirming, and needing, you know, that I want to go over that. But before we get there, one of the things that I come across all the time in burnout work is like, I don't actually believe in burnout prevention for neurological reasons. I can get into that. But what I'm wondering is, if the same things that lead people to a higher vulnerability to burnout are similar things that lead people to maybe a higher or a lesser ability to notice when people are reaching out with bids for mattering. You mentioned Gottman's Institute in the book, so I'm going with, I went with the word bids, but yeah.
Yeah, I like that word.
Yeah, I do too. But like, so with, in burnout, a lot of the development that leads to it happens in childhood. And it is lack of secure attachment, not mattering, right? Right. So we're going all the way back to the beginning with it. And your brain develops a certain way and your hormones develop a certain way. And you are less likely to choose things that are a good fit for you. You're less likely to believe that you deserve a better job. You're less likely to take in when other people offer those bids. So leadership's job is, yes, to upskill in this, because everybody needs to upskill in this. Even when I was reading the book, I was like, I know all this shit and I still need to upskill in this. That is just,
yeah, me too.
You know, like, yeah, okay, I need to be better at it. But are we hitting a wall if we don't also acknowledge, or maybe you think or don't think this is true, I'm not sure, that some people have a harder time accepting the bids?
Well, yeah, I mean, social support is a key mitigator of burnout.
Yeah.
It's a key predictor of resilience. It's always has been, right? The problem is not that leaders are struggling more. The problem is that leaders are struggling alone more.
Yeah, but I'm thinking about the other people. So if we have a team member and a leader is being told to, like, you know, make sure they know that they matter more, but that team member is having a hard time taking, like, doesn't believe the leader's words or doesn't trust that, you know, like... Is there, because in burnout, that's the issue. that people are like, yeah, but you can fix the resilience.
I thought you were talking about the leaders themselves are burnt out, which...
No, which is also another problem.
Which they are, because if 100%. You are a leader and you're struggling, it's very hard to be aware of these cues. It's very hard to look outward. But that's where I always say, like, if someone is, if a team member is saying, oh, like, you know, my leader's not doing this for me, that the question is always, are you doing it for them? Right, because mattering is non-directional. Like, the quality of a relationship is determined by the least interested participant. I'll say that again. The quality of any relationship, including a leader-follower relationship, is determined. It's capped at the least interested party. So if you want your leader to check in on you authentically and you're not checking in with them authentically, you're not going to activate what psychologists call complementarity, which is a relationship that is twofold. And I see this all the time, that when we don't feel that we matter, we actually go into withdrawal. So we withdraw, we isolate, or we move into acts of desperation.
Yeah.
We complain, gossip, right? So I really want to see people to start putting forth into a relationship what they want to receive from a relationship on all levels. That's why this is a cultural systemic problem, not just a leadership problem.
Yeah.
Now, as leaders can also be pretty bad at implementing some of these things. So a lot of times I do workshops and people are really excited about
that. Super vulnerable.
Right. So, but they're excited about it. And then they'll do something like, okay, one of the practices I have, you've probably heard this from Jerry, is a red, yellow, green check-in, right? Just a low barrier of entry way to see how people are doing, to gather data so you can lead them better, which has been shown to decrease burnout, increase engagement, even patient satisfaction in hospital settings. And I'll introduce that and somebody will be like, okay, I'm going to go, okay, everybody, now I haven't talked to you in a year. I haven't ever asked how you're doing. I haven't ever checked in on you.
Are you red or yellow?
I never ask questions, but we're going to do this new thing. We're going to do a green, yellow, red check-in. Right. So I think that's where a lot of times someone who's burnt out, their leader goes to a burnout session. They learn about a green, yellow, red check-in and they come in and do that practice like that. That is going to give that experience that you mentioned where it's like, what? Come on. Whatever. I don't believe you. Right.
Yeah.
What we have to get at is we have to get to the point where the leader is saying, I recognize that people are unnoticed here. Like, I recognize that myself. I sometimes feel that way. I want to create a place where we're seeing and hearing each other and building real relationships. I'm going to try some things and they may not work, but I need you to tell me if they're working. But the non-negotiable here is that we're going to make sure people feel noticed and they feel affirmed and they feel needed here. So just like, you know, that's my aim. I'm going to try some things that aren't, you may be like, what is going on? But I want you to help me.
Yeah. So in my keynotes, that particular skill that you're mentioning now is, I call that changing the monopoly rules.
Yeah.
That, right? Like, you're about to change the rules of the game. You have to tell people that they're different before you introduce a new portion of it. Like, you've got to let people know, hey, we haven't been playing right. The house rules have changed. Here's how they've changed. And here's what's going to be happening. We call that changing the rules of monopoly.
And not only that we're going to change things, but that the way things are deeply affects me as a leader. Yeah. Because I also, I'll give like an example, like active listening training. I always know when a friend has gone to active listening training because they're all of a sudden like, what I hear you saying is, right? That actually doesn't make you feel heard, right? Whether the person actually wants to understand, has that inherent desire and curiosity to understand the meaning behind my words is what helps me feel heard. So when I'm working with leaders on this, I say, you have to want.
To do the dishes.
You have to be interested.
Yeah.
And authentically interested. This isn't a tactic. This is a way of being. And so we have to set that intention first and dig and uncover all the limitations of that. And usually that is what can really help people take the step forward, sort of unblock that block that people have that I'm not going to do this, or I'm going to do this inauthentically.
Yeah. Curiosity is the thing. All right. So now let's get into the noticing, affirming, needing.
Yes. I'm glad we had that conversation before this.
Right?
Yes.
So noticing, affirming, needing is the method behind the madness, sort of, right? Like, here are the things that must be in existence in order for mattering to be.
Yes, pretty much every human being wants to feel seen and heard, wants to feel that they have gifts that are making a difference, and wants to feel needed.
These are the initial, the very first fried episodes say in the very beginning of them, you are here and we want you to know that you are seen and heard and we believe you. And like that, it's like seen, heard, validated. Like that is, it was the beginning of the first five seasons of the show. Those exact words, because in the world of Chinese medicine, that's the prerequisite for healing. It's not whether or not somebody does an acupuncture appointment. It's not whether or not somebody takes herbs. It's not whether or not they do a surgery. It's not whether or not, it's whether they come into your office and are seen, heard, and valued.
Interesting. There's a book called Deep Survival by Lawrence Gonzalez. He's a journalist. He actually studied like who survives like these wilderness survival scenarios and who doesn't, like what their characteristics are. It's like a fascinating book. And the only difference for people who survive and don't survive is that they have someone to get home to.
Yeah.
And they think about them, or they have an unfinished project that they want to get done and they think about it. They matter.
Yeah.
There's some pulling force. So that ecosystem of feeling seen, heard, valued, and needed, that other people are around you, that you are valued and valuable, is a pulling force that pulls us forward. And psychologically pulls us forward versus like motivation, tactics, and things push us.
Yeah.
But pushing, you have to keep
intrinsic
pushing.
Intrinsic and extrinsic.
Pulling force psychologically. Yeah. And so, yes, people feel that they matter when they feel noticed, when they feel affirmed, when they feel needed. The key, though, is there are skills and practices that have to be adopted to make that come to life. For example, you can't just say, hey, we see you here. That's like saying, our people are our greatest asset, but then you put them you put them as an expense on the line item budget, right? You can't just say, like, we see you here, we value our people. Or my favorite is, we care about our people. There's a big difference between caring about somebody and caring for somebody.
Yeah.
Like, you have to get up close to care for somebody. So these things have to be active, and they have to be activated through skills, habits, and practices, not just intuition, in everyday interactions.
So noticing. The download on your website, the 25 essential skills to show people how they matter.
Oh, I'm glad you downloaded that.
Fabulously done. And it's what's really interesting is that you read it, like you said before, you read it and you're like, well, that's not so hard. But then when you read through the book and you're like, are you actually doing this? And here's how you check whether or not you're actually doing this. It's a little jarring.
It is. I mean, think about—
in a good way.
Yeah. I mean, think about conversations you had last week.
Yeah.
Think about conversations you're still thinking about. Have you reached out and told that person you're thinking about it, or followed up and closed the loop? You know, many people listening right now probably be like, oh gosh, I was just going to wait to the meeting next week. Yeah. But this is what we do, right? So it's, or think of someone you're grateful for right now. Now think about the last time you explicitly told them.
Yeah.
If you're like many, like the John Templeton Foundation finds that 90% of people can just name a person.
Yeah.
Less than 20% say they told them explicitly in the last 5 days. So again, we get this, when you bring it to conscious awareness, which is the goal, when you name it, you can start taking it out of just intuition and turning it into practice. And this is important in organizations because intuition doesn't scale very well.
That's the understatement of the century.
Yeah, like practices, habits, and skills scale. Like that CEO told me, I'm not going to tell them to tie their shoes, like how to have a conversation with people. I'm like, then you're relying on intuition. You don't know whether they have the skills to do this. And so it's very likely that it won't happen. It's why we don't rely on intuition for pilots to fly planes. They have a checklist every time they go in because the weather can be different. Customers can be unruly. There can be delays. There's all of these outside factors that are pulling you away from doing the thing that you're an expert in, which for leaders, you should be an expert in human beings. And there's so many things that are pulling you away. So you go back to that checklist. The leader's version of that is, here's how I'm going to show up in this next interaction. Here's my articulated intention. My occupation is to be responsible for where human beings spend a third of their one waking life. And here's how I'm going to show up. That is how we need, in my opinion, how we need to approach this pivotal experience of mattering and leadership.
Do you think that leaders are right now feeling a little overburdened with the need to meet KPIs and also meet all the needs of the people in the room?
Yes. I mean, we have leaders in a hurry.
Yeah.
And hurry and care can't coexist.
Yeah. I loved that. I highlighted that sentence in the book.
I'm glad you did, because it helps. I remember it all the time. Like, you cannot care for anything if you're in a hurry. We have more platforms than ever for leaders. They're tracking their progress, tracking this KPI, tracking this metric. You can be in a meeting and on your phone responding to an email from your boss while you're supposed to be in this one-on-one meeting. Yeah. People are stacked in these meetings all day long. We are hybrid, virtual, which that presents barriers to mattering, because I can just click leave after I'm done with the meeting. I don't have to think about you till next week, which is very unnatural. Think about that.
Yeah.
Like, if you're frustrated in this call, I can just, like, there's someone in Zoom right now. There's a little icon, this person walking out a red door.
Yeah.
I can just click leave and you disappear as a leader. That's not natural. That's not normal. And so we're in this place where we're constantly in a hurry. There was a McKinsey study that found that people managers report just spending 22% of their time with their people.
Yeah.
The rest is on, like, administrative tasks. The rest is on strategic priorities imposed on them from above, or individual contributor tasks.
And that's the issue that we're facing most of the time, I think.
Huge issue. Yeah. Right? I mean, so systemically.
Yeah, exactly.
If I'm talking to someone who has architecture over that system.
Yeah.
We have to make it possible for people to do these things for other people.
Right.
We have to create systems that make it possible. You know, Jerry Colonna always says, like, how are you complicit in creating the conditions
you
don't want?
You say you don't want. Yeah.
And
yeah.
That's if people don't feel that they matter, how are you complicit in creating the conditions where leaders don't do this? That's a big question at the top. But for leaders, you can't let that take away the one power you always have, which is the power to show up in your next interaction and show that person how they're seen, heard, and valued. You do not need your organization's permission or approval to notice, affirm, and show someone how they're needed. I think too many leaders, especially in the middle, give up their interactional power.
Yeah.
That they always have. And to be honest, culture is the accumulation of interactions.
Of course. This is something that...
It's very important to take your interactions captive.
Yeah.
Because all of the practices that we talk about, like on that 25 skills list, all of them can be done in your next interaction.
Yeah.
But
they're not, like, insanely difficult and or, like, hard to, you know, just...
No app, no platform.
Right,
no,
exactly.
No KPI associated with it.
Yeah.
It's simply a choice to show up in your next interaction in a way that helps that person feel that they matter.
This was something that was that came up a lot. My husband left a job a couple of years ago, and he had, you know, steadily moved up in the ranks and went through, it was a major corporation, so went through a 360 at some point and went through a leadership development plan and went through all of these things. And his first round at leadership did not go well at all. By the time he got to his second round, it was 5 or 6 years later, his emotional maturity was in a different place. He was really in a much different place and was a very, very good leader. And the company was going through major tumultuous change, like the pandemic threw them into major change. And they had their employee engagement survey, and he scored a 4.8 out of 5, and the average in the company was 4.2.
Hmm.
And they were like, and so when I read, there was a section in your book that there was one outlier, and they asked all the team members, well, what was this leader doing that made you give this level of score? And they were like, well, he knows who I am and what I need and what's important to me and what my kids' names are and all. And I was like, oh, this is exactly what was happening with my husband at that company at that time. He handpicked every single person on his team. He knew everything about them. He talked to them every single week about various things that he would send them text messages on a Tuesday because of whatever, you know, like, I was like, oh, this was the difference.
Yeah, he was a noticer. I mean, he...
Not the first time around, though. He had to learn.
Yeah, this. I mean, I would be curious as to how he was trained to be a leader. Because oftentimes, you know, we treat leadership as, we'll just hire a good person and expect that they'll be able to lead.
Do you know
people.
What I think happened the first time when he stumbled, when he came back and on his own went through the leadership that he had in the past and what really worked for him and what didn't, and just started doing it.
Think about this, though. This is a little bit of an aside.
Yeah, that's fine.
We have to start treating leadership as a separate occupation.
Amen.
Because you would never, for example, you would never hire an accountant who just had to figure it out on their own.
No.
Read books or do some self-reflection or go to do a module.
Yeah.
No, we have standards. There's standards. There is quality controls. There are specific competencies you need to touch financial documents. There should be competencies you need to exhibit before you're responsible for where human beings spend a third of their life.
Well, and it's interesting. The interesting thing about this is that I've lived in a few different countries and you know, things are different in different places. And one of the places that I lived was Poland, and Poland is extremely hierarchical.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So leadership in Poland is very much, I tell you, you listen.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of interest. It's changing now. And I have friends that do similar work to us that are trying like hell to get in there and break down the system a little bit. But we'd have to come to a consensus about what good is first. And we can't even come to a consensus about which way we're supposed to put the toilet paper roll on.
Yeah. I would also say in those environments, for example, I work with one of the clients I worked with a couple of years ago before a lot of things are happening. It was the U.S. Army.
Yeah.
And very command and control. But the success of the Army in a division relied on whether a unit leader was doing these things. So, yes, there's command and control from the top, but the microclimate that's created by the team leader was most important for mission success.
Yeah.
And what were some of those things? I mean, connects us to the bigger mission, shows me how my inputs make a difference on the bigger whole, knows my kids' names. I had someone who was responsible for the special forces training at the Kennedy School of Special Warfare say, you know, the predictor of a lethal unit behind enemy lines. I mean, this is, you're talking about life and death situation, is not toughness, it's love. Like, no one is going to sacrifice for me if I haven't demonstrated care for them, if I don't know anything about their lives, if I don't invest in them. Another group, the Blue Angels, I talked with the commander of the Blue Angels. They spend 5 months just living together before they train together. And because, again, you can't lead somebody you don't understand. You can't understand somebody you don't spend time with and pay attention to, that you don't notice, that you don't understand their gifts, that they don't understand how you need them. And so even in these very hierarchical cultures, you'll find pockets, even in Poland, where the system keeps going because of leaders who choose to lead in these ways that are time-tested, that create trust. I believe that those 25 skills to create mattering, yeah, I would like to see those be the minimum qualification for a leader to be a leader.
Yeah. And like we said, like, none of them are hard, but some of them are not, they're not automatic. You have to make them.
No, definitely. Yeah.
You have to make them automatic.
Yeah. Everything wants us to be in a hurry, acquire, achieve for ourselves, protect the resources we have. That's how many of us are educated. That's how many of us are rewarded. But what really fosters the human energy to do these things are asking really good questions of people that people can answer, instead of, how is your day? What is your attention today? What are you struggling with? How can I help? Doing check-ins, like the green, yellow, red check-in, instead of just saying, hey, good job, stopping and showing people the difference that they make and naming exactly how they make that difference.
Yeah.
Being able to not just know or expect that people know that they're relied on, being able to show them measurably, hey, here's what would happen if it wasn't for you.
Yeah.
Like that supervisor of the janitor said, imagine if this place went on strike.
Yeah.
Right. So these are skills that you can learn and embed into interactions. And it's really not about adding more to your plate or adding more interactions. It's usually about optimizing the interactions you already have.
Right. Right. The other thing that I'm thinking about, so on these skills, there's skills for noticing people, there's skills for affirming people, and skills for showing other people that they're needed. Now, Here's where my personal background and my history and my tilt towards hyper-independence comes into friction. First, I'll say that I worked as a bartender throughout college and grad school. And I had a boss who I love dearly. We're still close. I still talk to him all these years later. It's been 20 years since I bartended. But he would say all the time, "You are replaceable." Literally tell us, like, if you don't want to show up, then screw you. Somebody else will show up and make this money. Like, we don't care. You are replaceable. You do not matter. Literally. And that was, at that time, a relief for me, because it meant to me that all I had to do was show up. And that was more than what other people were doing. That was one thing. And then when I found myself, when I was reading the book about making sure that people know that their work is essential, that the work that they're doing is significant to the whole and all of that. My need for autonomy and independence felt a little like I started to squeeze a little bit. I was like, I don't always want to know that I'm that significant to you. Like, I want to know that if I die, you're going to be fine if I die. You know, yeah, like, I mean, you will be okay. Yeah. So I had a little bit of like my own personal like, when I read that section. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, so the problem is that we're interdependent.
Yeah.
Shit. As just a species, right? And interdependent means needed by each other. I mean, even if you pretend that you're not needed by others, you are, and you need others. Like, I always think about this every time I'm on a call like this. Like, we literally need software engineers and to
I have a podcast episode about that.
But we can't pick and choose what, if we're needed or not.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the one problem. We can talk about that individually later.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
The second thing you're talking about is there is a dark side to this being needed, which is codependence.
Yeah.
Some people weaponize our inherent need as human beings to be needed by other people. And we do have an inherent need to be needed. We're actually optimized when we are relied on, when we're called on to help in a crisis, when we're called on because our expertise is needed, when we are, when people, like what happens to people when they're called upon to help another person.
Yeah.
Those heroic instances of a police officer diving into an icy lake, right? What the body does when we're needed by another person is really remarkable. So it's something that's hardwired into us, but some people can weaponize that.
Yeah.
Codependence is like when a clinical lead at a hospital says, "If you don't show up, the whole unit's done. We're not going to be able to serve our patients. So remember why you got into this, to serve patients. You better show up." That's codependence. That's using the need to be needed to manipulate somebody to show up. It's saying, hey, my well-being and our well-being relies on you. That's different. What I'm talking about feeling needed is...
Yeah.
Not that a job isn't replaceable or someone's skills aren't replaceable, but that someone and their unique life, their unique perspective, their unique gifts are never replaceable. And making sure they know that. They know that they and their gifts are relied on, but that, yes, we'll be okay if you weren't there, but your presence makes things better and we need you. So it's much different than the codependence aspect, which may
create that friction, create that internal tension. And
I will say though that, let's go back to the example of the bartending, right? You were like, oh, well, I'll just show up. The bar is lower. When somebody, this came from the Industrial Revolution, when somebody said, don't forget you're replaceable. You're just a cog in the machine. That does two things. It socializes you to expect less. This is just a job, right? It also gives permission for people in the workplace to dehumanize workers.
Yeah.
It's just a job. You're replaceable. So, and that's a tactic. That whole don't forget that you're replaceable at work is actually a tactic used by managers to make it easier for them to dehumanize you and to get you to expect less. The reality psychologically is that when people feel replaceable, they act replaceable.
Yeah.
You know, one of the studies that I love, it's one of my favorite studies, is this, psychologist, actually agricultural engineer named Max Ringelmann. He had students pull on a rope as hard as they could.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and he attached it to a dynamometer that measures force.
Yeah.
And he was measuring how hard they pulled on the rope, and then he got them into groups, measured how hard they pulled. And the individuals exhibited the more total force every single time than the groups. And the key mechanism of that is that the individuals knew that their effort was indispensable, that no one was going to, quote unquote, pick up the slack. So that's what happens to the human brain and body when we feel that we're irreplaceable. So if you're a leader and you think that telling people that they're replaceable is a motivational tactic, you're wrong. And you're actually going against pretty much everything we know about human psychology.
Yeah.
You also have to be careful not to weaponize that to create codependence.
Right.
Simple things like, hey, I just want to let you know that if it wasn't for your work in this meeting, like we wouldn't have come up with some of the ideas we came up with. Or yeah. If somebody's absent, being like, hey, we really missed you yesterday. I could have used your perspective on this. Or saying, hey, look at this outcome. I know the organization achieved this outcome. I want to just walk you back and show you measurably how you made that happen. That's what I'm talking about yeah. helping people see how they're needed.
Yeah. Well, thanks. I feel better now. Just so everybody knows, and everybody that's been around here for a while already knows, a lot of these episodes are personal therapy sessions for me. And then I get people that are like, I was thinking that too. I'm like, that's why I do it, because all of us have these weird pushbacks against things that we're missing a level of understanding about. I think there's always a lot less to push back about when you have a fuller picture of something. So thank you for allowing me to go there and then carrying me through.
Yeah. And the problem is that so many of these concepts have been framed as dichotomies.
Yes.
So like you are enough on your own. No one is coming to save you. All of these self-help messages. Yeah. That's not true. I mean, so it's true, yes, that you can build your sense of self.
Sure.
It's also true that your sense of self is determined by the signals you get from others. So if you're just focused on yourself and you're not going out there and creating relationships in which others feel seen, heard, valued, and needed, you're actually just burdening more people to do their own self-help work, right? Which is what we've done.
Yeah.
So it has to be both, right? Like people bristle, especially like some fans of some higher level psychologists bristle when I say you are not enough on your own. And that's an important thing to understand, because it guides how we show up. You don't develop confidence by sitting in your office chanting self-affirmations to yourself.
No.
Like really, you develop lasting confidence when you can go out and try stuff and someone has your back.
And you succeed and you can celebrate with somebody.
And you have support by somebody. Yeah. And we can't lose that. And I believe that one of the reasons why we've gotten into this place is that for the last 50 years, we've taught everybody how to optimize themselves. And so everybody's trying to actualize themselves.
Yeah.
And we've depleted the skills and the investment to go out there and optimize other people to optimize ourselves. That whole quip, and you can search it. It's a popular influencer who always says, no one's coming to save you. And my comment every time I see that is, what if they did?
Yeah.
Like, what if you could work on hard stuff, you could develop your own sense of fortitude and resilience, and you had support, and we showed up for one another? Isn't that the real message?
I know you did not listen to this recently, but this is the second conversation almost in a row that I've had with a podcast guest where we are going back from self to community. So it feels like as an overarching idea, we are sliding back in that direction. And I'm really grateful for that, because it is one of the things that I struggle with. I had to remind myself, okay, like somebody made my desk and somebody had to create this software and somebody had to. And so all of these people, just to sit in my room, there's like 100,000 people had to exist so I could sit in my office. So many people. I needed so many people for this to be possible. But I have to remind myself of that on a very regular basis, because my tendency is to overachieve alone.
I need to hear the most.
Yeah, like it's so important for me to like continually have that message. And I told you we were going to go about 40 minutes, but we are close to the top of the hour. And I think we're not quite done, but we're going to wrap up anyway.
Sounds good.
Zach, last message, plus then where can people find you? How can they hire you? All that good stuff.
Yeah. One last message I have is that it can be overwhelming. You know, you probably like, oh my gosh, I don't do this, or I'm so into myself, or just drop that guilt. It's all about doing small things. What can you do in your next interaction? I would say a great place to start is just to ask the people around you. I mean, start with your family or friends. Like, when you feel that you matter to me, what am I doing? And write those things down and do more of those things. That's as simple as it can be to start. When you feel that you matter to me, what am I doing? Why are you friends with me? You know, and write those things down. I mean, really. And do more of those things, because that'll help you see that you matter, and it'll help opening up that conversation. The second is that ZachMercurio.com, there's a learn and then there's a mattering tab. There's a 31 day like mattering challenge of a small thing you can do every day that's in there. There's also just this like 25 skills piece that you can take a look at. And then there's some templates that you can just download. You don't need to give me your email address or anything. Just download them and use them. And that's a good place to start.
And that's the same website people will go to if they're listening. There's an event planner listening right now. And they're like, oh my God, if we don't hire Zach tomorrow, we're screwed.
That is the same website.
Okay, yes, same website. Yeah, just making that clear.
There's a speaking tab, a workshops tab.
Great.
But dig into the mattering stuff first and really see if you believe in this, because that intention is important.
Fried fam. I hope you got as much out of this as I did. Zach, I am supremely grateful, not only for your work, but for the way that you show up in conversation. It's obvious that you've practiced a lot of the things that you're teaching, and it's not the first time that I noticed this. I noticed it that when I met you the very first day, I went up to you after your talk and you looked at me. Speakers sometimes are looking for the next most important person.
Oh,
In the room. Is there somebody better?
That look, around? That like glaze look. It can be the CEO look too.
That's what I felt. Yeah. It can be just and you did not do that. So thank you for living your work.
My pleasure. There's really no better place than where you are. That's what I've learned.
And we'll end on that, Fried Fam. Until next time. Welcome to Fried, the Burnout Podcast. I'm your host, Kate Donovan, burnout expert, keynote speaker, and author focused on burnout as a match issue at work. Fried looks at burnout as information, not failure. When people, roles, expectations, leadership behaviors, and systems fall out of alignment, burnout is often the signal. Seasons 1 through 10 of Fried focus primarily on individual burnout and recovery, and those episodes are still available. You can use the Fried episode finder to find the conversations that best match what you're dealing with right now. Starting in season 11, the focus shifts to the workplace. The conversations center on how leaders and organizations can improve match and get rid of burnout in realistic, sustainable ways. I also work directly with companies and events through burnout and emotional intelligence keynotes, workshops, and longer-term advisory work. If burnout has been getting your attention, this podcast will help you understand what it's pointing to and how to find a better match.
Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Got each other on our side, plus all the folks at Fried, the Burnout Podcast.